The conclusion we reached at the time, which was quite groundbreaking back in 2018, was that it was possible to decarbonize those hard-to-abate sectors, even if it was harder.
Development of technologies, I think, within the UK and venture capital investment isn't a larger problem. I think the larger problem is scaling these technologies into commercial, scalable businesses.
In the boom year of 2008, there was about $6 billion of venture funding disbursed. In 2021, it was $21 billion. So there's been a huge increase. This is now the second coming, if you like, of clean tech, and people mean it now.
Welcome back to Net Zero, What's Innovation Got to Do with It? The podcast where we explore one of the critical ingredients for decarbonising our economies at breakneck speed, innovation. I'm Nina Foster.
And I'm Simon Retallick, and together we work for the Carbon Trust Net Zero Intelligence Unit. Today's episode is our series finale, and we're rounding off our exploration of innovation with a deep dive into the decarbonisation of the so-called hard-to-abate or hard-to-decarbonise sectors, such as heavy industry, aviation and shipping.
Now, these sectors are responsible for around a third of global CO2 emissions, but reducing these emissions is very challenging because existing technologies are either not effective or they're highly costly. So to put just one of those sectors into perspective, if steel were a country, it'd be the fifth biggest emitter in the world. And without dramatic change, steel production could emit 20% of the world's remaining global carbon budget for limiting warming to 1.5°C.
Now, to help prevent that from happening, we might learn to use less steel. We might also learn to fly less and localise trade, but none of those things will be easy or necessarily popular to achieve, which is why the race is on to develop new technological solutions and scale them up rapidly. And of course, that's where innovation comes in.
And in some hard-to-abate sectors, that innovation is already starting to bear fruit. So coming back to the example of steel, it's now beginning to be produced using electric arc furnaces across the EU. But are solutions emerging in other sectors? How should effective innovation be supported? And how do we ensure that people benefit equally around the world?
To help us explore these questions, we are joined by three expert guests. Faustine de la Salle, CEO of Mission Possible Partnership, a community of industry leaders working to decarbonise heavy industry and transport. Rob Trezona, founder of Cleantech Venture Fund, Kiko Ventures. And Ross Bruton, head of ventures at the Carbon Trust, where he leads the delivery of business acceleration support for the UK government's £1 billion net zero innovation portfolio, otherwise known as NZIP. Welcome, Faustine, Rob and Ross. Before we dive in, I have to ask about the wonderful names your organisations have. Faustine, starting with you, the Tom Cruise blockbusters have to be the inspiration for yours, right?
Absolutely. And this name came from a first report we published back in 2018, which was the first report actually to popularize the term hard to abate sectors from the Energy Transitions Commission, which I used to lead. And the conclusion we reached at the time, which was quite groundbreaking back in 2018, was that it was possible to decarbonize those hard to abate sectors, even if it was harder. Hence the very popular title Mission Possible, which has now translated into a full organization.
Fantastic. And Rob, what inspired the name Kiko? I assume it wasn't the Italian brand of lipsticks which share that name.
No, it is not. The difficulty of finding an original name for a climate venture organization is a symptom of the success of the sector. So we wanted to create a dedicated climate brand as part of the IP Group portfolio, which is the parent company of Kiko Ventures. We did actually approach Faustine and said, how about Transition Ventures? But they weren't that excited about that. So we spent a bunch of time with some sort of agencies. We chose Kiko because it means climate in Japanese. And we spoke to a bunch of people we know from Japan. Is this okay? It's not cultural appropriation. It's a short name. It's highly memorable. And we are friends with the cosmetics brand and had a few correspondence.
Really,
it's clear that, you know, we're doing very different things.
Very,
You know, we're focused on climate and decarbonisation.
Brilliant, it's a great one. Ross, I'm not sure there's too much to say about where you're from, other than NZIP, of course, is a great addition to the growing list of weird and wonderful net zero related acronyms out there.
Oh, there are many. Absolutely. Yes. The Net Zero Innovation Portfolio was essentially £1 billion portfolio, as you mentioned, launched in 2019, running up into 2024. So another acronym, I guess, for us to all memorize.
Absolutely. Well, let's begin our conversation by understanding a bit more about the sectors that are more challenging to decarbonize. Faustine, you've clearly worked on the energy transition for many years, and in your role at Mission Possible Partnership, you're now focusing exclusively, I think, on the so-called hard-to-abate sectors, as you were talking about. Why are heavy industry and international transport so hard to decarbonize?
When we invented the term, we opposed it to what we considered as easier to abate sectors, sectors that could benefit from the ongoing trend in terms of cost reduction of clean energy and clean renewable electricity in particular. So it was by opposition to all sectors that already use electricity as their main source of energy, like, for instance, our home appliances, and in opposition to sectors that could easily be electrified, like road transport. And so we've focused our minds on those sectors where electricity used directly didn't seem to be the solution yet technologically, which included heavy industries that require very high temperatures, heavy industries that use fossil fuels as their feedstock, like the chemical industry to produce plastics, and long distance transport that requires the density of a liquid fuel to have enough energy to do very long distances. Trips to Australia are things that are difficult to handle with batteries at this stage.
Ross, it's clear that those sectors, therefore, are more in need of innovation to decarbonize than others, such as domestic transport. But what type of innovation is most needed? Is it a case of more research and development into new technologies, or demonstration and incubation of existing ones?
Well, I think it's both. I think if you look at the latest International Energy Agency data around the carbon reductions that we require by 2050, approximately half of those are for technologies in the prototyping and development stage. And another third of those are technologies that are currently available in the market, but desperately need to scale. They need the infrastructure, they need the policy alignment, they need the supply chains to be able to reach maturity and reach prosperity with a lot of the incumbent technologies that exist. So we need to support early stage innovation. We need to get them to embed customer-centric designs, customer-centric thinking into the commercial models and the business models that they develop. That all starts with early stage engagement with the market, early stage engagement with the ultimate off-takers, as well as with their supply chain, as well as with investors, in order for them to develop these kind of business models that can ultimately be commercialized, seek that investment, and then scaled afterwards. We get a lot of technologies that become commercially ready, but the market isn't ready to accept those technologies to scale just yet. So better understanding and getting that early stage understanding for innovators to know how to develop their business models so that they can take advantage of the market as it is today and make sure they're ready to scale once that alignment takes place.
Okay, fantastic. So it's clear there are lots of different flavors of innovation that are highly relevant to this challenge. It'd be great to bring that to life a bit. In your work helping startups take their clean tech ideas from concept to commercial viability, what are some of the most exciting examples of new technologies that you've seen that could help to shift the dial on hard to abate sectors in particular?
Oh, there are many, and we work with quite a few of them. I think within the hard to abate sectors, two key areas is that of fuel switching, so moving from fossil fuels to different forms of hydrogen or different forms of hydrogen gas based blends, carbon capture utilization and storage, or direct air capture are key areas there as well as just general electrification, whether that is from a mobility perspective, whether that's from an industry-based perspective. I think some of the more interesting projects that have come across my desk recently, the likes of Locogen, really interesting innovator and developer that's developing the first-of-a-kind project in zero-emission distilleries up in Scotland, essentially combining a hydrogen burner with on-site renewables. We have the likes of Bramble, which Rob will know really well, which is essentially developing low-cost, high-performance fuel cells, leveraging a significant base of printed circuit board manufacturing capacity globally in order to scale their technologies, whether that's for on-site power, whether it's for motive power. I think when we start thinking about CCUS or something, when the more interesting trends there is not just carbon capture, but utilization of that captured carbon into different forms of materials and products. So we see the likes of Econic, which is a really interesting technology, and a really interesting innovator that's essentially developing from the captured carbon. Their technology is able to develop different forms of polyols or oil-based products and materials that can be used in common consumable products, whether that's cars, clothes, construction materials, mattresses. Other interesting technologies, the likes of CCM technologies, their technology is leveraging different forms of carbon that's been captured, combining that with agricultural and industrial waste to develop different forms of carbon-neutral fertilizers, nutrient-rich carbon-neutral fertilizers.
Fascinating. Lots of potential applications, clearly, for sectors like agriculture and industry there. What about aviation? I know, Faustin, aviation is one of your target sort of sectors, mission possible partnerships. Have you seen any promising technologies for decarbonizing that sector?
Yeah, I think there's a range of technologies that are of interest in aviation. There's a kind of short-term range of technologies that can be used in existing planes, which is really interesting because that enables you to blend traditional conventional jet fuel with fuels that are more sustainable, either based on bioresources or on power to liquids, and enables you to utilize the existing infrastructure. So the switch is much easier than if you have to rebuild a whole infrastructure. But then a bit lower down the line, we have opportunities to electrify aviation or to use hydrogen aviation as well for short to medium distance aviation. That will require more investment in infrastructure at airports in particular, and a rethink of the airframes themselves. But there's a lot of potential there too. And I was in a very good session at COP last year, where the different innovators developing hydrogen planes and electrified planes were competing on the date by which they hope to put their first commercial airplane out, some citing 2025, 2026 as a potential horizon. So they might be very bold in terms of timing, but I think it's exciting to see the developments there.
That is interesting. There's a lot of pessimism about aviation, I think. So it's encouraging to hear about those developments. Faustin, some might argue that all this focus on technology ignores the role that behavior change can play in decarbonizing these sectors, for instance, reducing demand for flights. With the goal of reaching net zero in just 26 years in mind, and the clock obviously ticking, what do you think the balance should be between focusing on behavior change on the one hand and developing new technologies on the other?
I think we need everything we can, right? We are losing the race against time and against climate change. The pace of change in the sectors that we're talking about today is insufficient, if we're honest, to meet our 2030 goals and our 2050 goals. And so we need to play on all fronts. We need to play on demand reduction. We need to play on energy efficiency as well. And we need to play on innovative technology developments. In our own kind of assessments, we've developed sector transition strategies for all harder to abate sectors. And overall, we consider that about 30% of the solution is demand reduction, a shift to a more circular economy, and energy efficiency combined. So it is a significant share of the solution space. And it's also what makes it cheaper. If you think about the steel sector, for instance, if you need to replace all current steel production with new hydrogen-based steel assets, it's a major source of investment you need. So the less steel and primary steel in particular you need in the system, the less investment you'll need in those industrial assets as well. It will be a cheaper pathway and a faster pathway if we really maximize demand reduction alongside investments in new technologies. Mm.
That's an important point. Thanks, Faustin.
Yeah, let's get onto that investment, because we heard about some fascinating technological innovations there, like zero emissions distilling, which sounds very appealing to me. but of course, those are going to require financial investment. We've got a real leading expert in the field here with us. But Rob, you actually started your career in research and development, where you led the team that created the world's first steel fuel cell. And now, of course, you're working on clean tech from another angle. You're actually investing in the solutions of the future. So to what extent was finance a barrier to clean tech back at the start of your career, and how has that changed?
Yeah, interesting question. So I started my career in the 2000s, and it'd be fair to say there was a bit of a clean tech boom at that period. I would say the sort of big event that kicked that off was a fuel cell company called Ballard in Canada. And they'd raised $750 million from Ford and Daimler to create a new type of, you know, car engine using hydrogen. The motivation at that time really wasn't necessarily even climate change. It was around clean air. So places like California with very bad air quality, were thinking of, you know, how do we replace gasoline engines? And it was, I would say, a period of optimism, absent the sort of overall roadmaps that we talk about now for net zero. It was sort of, can we try and improve the environment more generally? It was also a coincident with the end of the dot-com sort of boom. So people with venture money were looking to, what's the next big thing? So, clean technologies, why not? And this led to a lot of venture funding up to about 2008. Then we had the financial crisis, and it carried on for a bit because of the Obama stimulus. But then there was a bit of a sort of reaction against clean tech, even to the point where in the mid-2010s, clean tech was regarded as a sort of failed sector. There's a famous MIT paper nicknamed the Clean Tech is Dead paper that came out that reviewed all that stuff. So when I started, it was a lot of well-meaning and inexperienced people, very talented, in a small corner of venture that was sort of, you know, good intentions. Places like California, the UK as well, was quite busy. But it wasn't part of systematic overall industrial government policy. The Paris Climate Change Conference in particular has changed the overall perspective. And their conclusion to try and limit warming to 1.5 degrees, which led the IPCC to come out with how do you do that? And they kind of created this concept of net zero in 2018. I was there at the launch of that report. The world's changed from a sort of this is fun thing to do on the side, semi-philanthropic, to this is core government policy. We in the UK should be very proud of having legally binding climate targets that take us to net zero. And that's fundamentally changed the way finance and industry thinks about the sector. So there is now, in the boom year of 2008, there was about $6 billion of venture funding disbursed. In 2021, it was $21 billion. Wow. So there's been a huge increase. This is now the second coming, if you like, of clean tech. And people mean it now, so they're the real government sort of legally binding targets. And this is now at in the boards of large corporates. It's not the CSR marketing budget anymore. This is kind of core strategy for people in terms of steel, in terms of aviation, in terms of shipping. And so people mean it now, which is a bit late, actually, as Faustine was saying earlier. But that's at least happened. And I'd say the second coming, if you like, is a lot more capital, much more joined up thinking. There are infrastructure specialists as well as the venture specialists and growth equity as well. So we're delighted to see that the sector's kind of professionalized and got a lot larger. But it's, you know, there's still more to be done. We'd like to see more funds flow. We as Kiko are very collaborative. We work with a lot of the other investment organizations. So it's become a more nuanced, larger, more professional entity.
Mm, fascinating to hear about this second coming of clean tech. And you mentioned the UK having its own legally binding net zero target, and that really drives innovation. And actually, we kicked off this series with a conversation with Sir Patrick Vallance, the former chief scientific advisor to the UK government. And he told us that when the government is approaching innovation, it needs to take a portfolio risk, accepting that some solutions will fail while others succeed. And I know that's obviously a classic approach within venture capital. But do you think when you're investing in clean tech, there's more risk than investing in other sectors? How do you approach that risk profile?
Yeah, it comes up quite a lot, and particularly because most of the stuff that we back in terms of an impact and carbon reduction point of view is hardware. And so a lot of other people in the venture community who back software companies just ask questions about how is this possibly scalable? How can you get, you know, 10x, 20x return that you might want as a venture investor? And we're also backing new technologies. So there's a double challenge. It's capital intensive and it's quite risky. So we definitely take a portfolio approach. And maybe the third lens, and I've alluded to it earlier, is the critical role of public policy. So a reason, not one of many reasons, we are a proud member of the Energy Transitions Commission, which Faustine helped set up, is to really get ahead of the curve on where policy is going to be. There are several organizations around the world who influence policy, like IEA would be another one. But we are finding that the ETC is influencing policy. And the Mission Possible report in 2018 had a massive impact on people seeing the role of vectors like hydrogen to make things like sustainable aviation fuels to allow green steel to be possible. So the thing we've done to focus on that policy risk is try and get into the room, get ahead of the curve, have the analysis and the numbers. So that's very helpful. And the other piece that we do, and I alluded to sort of boardroom conversations, is try and work very closely with large corporates. And so we're also interested in what those organizations see as the priorities for them. And so as an example, a big area of focus when I was at the Carbon Trust was low carbon buildings and the built environment. We think the built environment has not progressed as rapidly as some of the other sectors in hard to abate. So we're kind of waiting on things like low carbon cement. Meanwhile, large organizations have hydrogen strategies or power to X strategies. And so we're having dialogues with senior executives in those organizations. So when you look at an early stage business, it's not just sort of, love the technology and it could be relevant. It's sort of love the technology. It's aligned with EU or IRA, US policy around the space. And we know 3, 4, 5 corporates who would adopt this, would help pilot it, would fund a pilot manufacturing facility. And that allows us to sort of still deliver decent returns while working in both a risky policy and a capital intensive space.
Ross, I wanted to come to you on that. Obviously, you work closely with the government's net zero innovation portfolio. What role do you see for government in making investment in technology more attractive and less risky? And where have you seen that done well?
Yeah, it's a really good question. Development of technologies, I think, within the UK and venture capital investment isn't a larger problem. I think the larger problem is scaling these technologies into commercial, scalable businesses. And in order to do that, you need to have a lot of the mechanisms that Faustine and Rob has been alluding to. And you need to have that early in the innovation stage of development for these companies. So I think number one is that policy certainty. It is the mandates that are put in place. It is the targets that are put in place that essentially incentivizes the market to start taking these innovators and these technologies seriously and start engaging with these technologies in a more meaningful and a professional manner. I think there is a lot of support that can be provided from a funding-based perspective and an incentive-based perspective to support these innovators scale. We've touched on it a few times in this discussion, and that is the readiness of the supply chain or value chains as well as the market to accept these technologies. In order to do that, these technologies need to be piloted at a commercial scale. They need first-of-a-kind commercial contracts. As Rob alluded to a bit earlier, these are risky. There are mechanisms that governments can put in place through first loss facilities or combining private sector capital with public sector capital in order to develop these kind of projects and demonstrate these technologies at scale. But there are also activities that can be taken to support in these technologies in reaching different forms of price parity or standards that we put in place in order to standardize components and the supply of materials for first-of-a-kind projects to reduce the costs of those, as well as to de-risk the off-takers or first customers of those projects in putting them into place. And I think from an actual innovator level, embedding those commercial skills within technology developers to think of themselves as commercializing companies and not just building technologies is something that is increasingly being embedded into public sector funded innovation programs and is quite critical if we're going to solve all the challenges that we've mentioned.
Well, let's get into that then, how we actually support those innovators, not just to be technical specialists, but commercial specialists as well. In your work, you're helping startups to take their technology from concept to commercial viability. So how do you do that? What are some key challenges that you see them facing and how do you help them overcome those?
It's a great question. And I think it is very nuanced depending on the stage of these companies. A lot of these programs are really significantly large. You deal with 100 different innovators. And I think one of the biggest challenges when it comes to clean tech, and we like to think about net zero innovators and climate tech innovators as sitting under a similar banner. They're not really. There is a significant range of different sectors, different applications, different forms of customer groups that these companies ultimately need to find a beachhead market in and ultimately need to scale in. So the way to support these companies is really on a very individualistic level, right? So we do have to run specific diagnostics with each one of these companies to better understand where their capabilities gaps sit and how those capability gaps, skills gaps, as well as market engagement gaps need to be met in order to fill their commercial development pathway. I think something that is critical when it comes to these companies is the team that's put in place. We get a lot of fantastic innovators and a lot of fantastic founders that know absolutely everything about their technology. But to talk about around my previous point, a lot of these individuals, this is the first kind of time they're developing a company, it's the first time they're developing a startup, and it is quite difficult, the early stage of development, to convince them that there is a need to embed a senior level management around the commercial thinking of that organization and developing that organization. So working on the team, and ultimately, actually, if you get the team right early on these companies, you get a lot of the other challenges correct because you've got individuals that know how to address them. I think from something that is often not considered by these companies is thinking about their technology as a wider system, right? These technologies are not being developed in isolation. Because we're looking at novel markets as much as we're looking at novel technologies, there are a variety of different technologies that often need to work in concert with this technology in order for that technology to reach commercialization and the system to reach commercialization. Mm. A simple example is, of course, renewable power being embedded into the grid, the need for flexibility, the need for energy storage, the need for demand response systems, so individuals at home or within industry, you having a flexible use of electricity in order for the full system to function. Long duration energy storage can only develop as fast as the market or the system is able to develop in its stead, at least within the country. These systems develop at different rates internationally. So I think thinking of a technology not as just its technology, but thinking of it as a system is something that we consistently try to engage with companies about as well.
So it sounds like there's a lot of innovators coming to market, and some of them need help to get to the next stage. But jumping back to the earliest stage, Rob, I wanted to ask you how you go about identifying the most potentially impactful clean tech solutions to invest in. What's your approach there?
Because of the type of businesses we back, which are it's typically very early stage and could take a long time to sort of get to an exit, you want to believe that the exit environment to which that company is being sold is a large market. And we use various sources to understand that, but a lot of it is the work that the ETC does on what is the necessary roadmap to net zero. By when do we need, you know, low carbon hydrogen, some sort of marine fuel that replaces bunker fuel? You know, when are we going to have some form of electric aviation? When is green steel going to likely happen? So we have views on that, and we actually describe being a member of the ETC as leveraged research. So there are 40 organizations. We put in a bit of funding, and we benefit from everyone else's expertise and funding. So that gives us a perspective on sort of not just what the needs are, but the timescales over which they may scale. So anything that we see a huge amount of innovation. I've got about 200 different startups in our investment pipeline at the moment. We're looking at, you know, is this something that's relevant to one of those big problems? If you're doing hardware investment and it's solving a small problem for a small market, we just don't find we can make a venture return. So big problem is the first filter. And then there are two other things we're looking for. Either, you mentioned team earlier, sort of world-class team who could execute something that may not rely on a breakthrough technology, but it's a new approach, or you've got some step change technology. Most of what we do is in the latter. So we're looking at maybe a spin-up from a university with some sort of breakthrough. And you know that is relevant to this. And I mentioned earlier the sort of conversations with the corporate. So quite early on, we'd be talking to people we know in large organizations saying, we found somebody, let's take sustainable aviation fuels and a particular company, OxCCU. We found someone who can, in a single step reaction, combine carbon dioxide and hydrogen and make, you know, C8, C16 jet fuel. Is that of interest? You know, sort of, I don't know, BP, Total, United Airlines. Oh, yes. You know, what are your benchmarks? What, you know, what is the overall cost of that reaction? What's the capital requirement? So we're quite early on both looking at the size of the problem that is being solved. Has anyone else got this? And does it mean something? Because there's no use building a wonderful new technology and it's just not on the strategies of some of those companies.
Fascinating. You've all in different ways articulated how interconnected this is. And for success to materialize when it comes to the race to net zero through decarbonizing sectors, including hard to abate ones through new technology, there's a huge alignment that needs to happen across a multitude of stakeholders. And that makes me think that collaboration is going to be vital if we're to scale this up. So Faustine, I wanted to turn to you on this. Clearly, one of the main aims of Mission Possible Partnership is to secure collaboration within sectors. Can you explain why that kind of collaboration is so important and also how you can achieve it given the pressures on individual companies in particular to compete with each other?
I think coming back to the basics and what I was saying earlier, you need a business case that holds for investment to flow. And the business case of an energy intensive company like a steel company doesn't rely exclusively on their own technologies and their own performance. It also relies on the cost of all of their supply, clean energy supply in the future, but also supply of mining materials, for instance. It relies on the revenues that they can extract and how they can position themselves on the market and whether that market values greener products or not. And it obviously also depends on the financial arrangements around both equity and project finance. And so in that complex web, if we want investments to flow towards projects that will be money-making, you need all of those pieces of the puzzle to align. Now, it's not necessarily a traditional way of operating for big industrial players to think through the whole supply chain and value chain. And it's also difficult for them because you have to work with a number of new players. A big steel company that is used to buying coking coal for its blast furnaces knows its coking coal providers really well, but they might not know hydrogen providers as well than their kind of traditional supply chain. So there's a whole new web of corporate relationships to be developed upstream and downstream to help improve the business case in the energy intensive part of the value chain. What we found is that the first step towards greater collaboration was actually to develop a shared vision of the future. And Rob spoke about it. We started that work in the Energy Transitions Commission and then deep dives through the Mission Possible Partnership on the sector transition strategies for each of the harder to abate sectors. And those transition strategies have been endorsed by more than 200 corporates. And it was really a lengthy work of collaboration across the value chain to set a shared vision of the future and make them understand how different players in the supply chain needed to play a role to improve the economics overall and make the business case hold. And once you have that vision, it becomes easier, but it's still not easy, to collaborate to the next level of granularity on actual on the enabling conditions that will enable investment. I think there's a lot of competition in the technology space. There's some work on pre-competitive technology development, but I think it's fairly limited, actually. Where we see the bigger space for collaboration is really on creating the enabling conditions for investment. So helping develop the clean energy supply chain that will serve multiple sectors, for instance. We've worked in industrial hubs where many companies across many sectors are centralized. For instance, if you take the Gulf Coast in the US, you have a major number of industrial sites in that region that need to decarbonize across steel, chemical sector, and other industrial sectors. And all of them will need some form of hydrogen infrastructure and some form of carbon management infrastructure. And so that's where there's a space for collaboration, is for them to work together on that shared clean energy infrastructure that they will all need if they want to decarbonize.
Rob, we've heard from both Faustine and Ross in different ways about the importance of system level change. Obviously, one of the key systems in all of this is the power system. We've been talking a lot about hard to abate sectors here today. The general assumption might be, well, power's sorted. You know, we've got the technology, solar, wind. Is that fair when it comes to power? Do you think there's still a need to invest in innovation? Where are the gaps and what are you interested in? How does that feature in your
One of the things that happened in my career, which didn't necessarily have to happen, is that wind and solar got cheaper than fossil. I remember being on the Google campus in 2008, and they were like, you know, hey, Google's going to turn up and solve this. We're going to make RE less than C because at the moment it's more expensive than coal. And solar was really a lot more expensive at that time. It was 10 times the cost per kilowatt hour. So the fact that we've had this massive decrease, particularly in solar, but also with wind, which has got a higher capacity factor, is massively important. And a lot of the solutions that we talked about now in Hard to Abate rely on the availability of low-cost green electrons from wind and solar. Again, it's worth reading the ECC work on this. Whilst things like nuclear and hydro can contribute, you know, moving up towards, we think, about 100,000 terawatt hours a year of power, most of that needs to come from wind and solar. So those two sort of sources are essential to transition and are essential for the hard to abate sectors to be realized. So if anyone's, you know, doing green hydrogen, they need green electrons. If anyone is doing an eSAF, they need green electrons. Green steel needs green electrons. So those two sources of clean energy are essential and are not being deployed fast enough. Solar is just about keeping up. It will need more integration with battery storage over the next few years. And, you know, they say Germany as a country heading towards 80 gigawatts of solar. In the summer, the marginal value of additional solar now is just starting to become almost negative. So we need to deploy batteries alongside solar. Wind, we think, is really important. We think could provide more of the actual terawatt hours of energy, maybe less of the capacity because it's got a higher capacity factor. So keeping a tracks on what's happening with the deployment of those technologies is important to our startups in the hard-to-abate sectors. So for once, the answer, even though I love funding innovation, for wind and solar is not more innovation. It's just get them deployed.
Right.
They're pretty popular, and they deliver very low-cost power for everyone, you know, not just in Europe, but Africa, you know, the global south. They are the cheapest form of new build power in most countries now.
Yeah, that's fascinating too. It's really underlined the importance of government in all this. Yeah. Good government, you point to as being essential too. You've talked earlier in some of your answers too about the importance of public policy in creating a more certain environment in which companies can invest, and obviously reduce risk for investors as well. Faustine, from your perspective at Mission Possible Partnerships, what more do you think governments should be doing, particularly to foster the sort of collaboration that you believe so much in, to crack the hard to abate sectors in particular?
Like, I think there's three, four major areas of intervention that we need going forward from governments. To enable collaboration, I'll be honest, we have issues with antitrust regulations. I think antitrust regulations are making companies very wary of collaboration, especially after a number of politically driven campaigns on the subject in the US over the past few years. And that is slowing down the pace of collaboration in a way that is unhelpful. But if you put that aside, I think in terms of just creating the right conditions for investment in the harder to abate sectors and in the decarbonization of the harder to abate sectors, you can basically play with three major levers of change that fundamentally affect the business case of investment. One is carbon pricing. And I think certainty around the carbon price and greater harmonization of carbon pricing mechanism across the globe is critical. And the European CBAM is a step that is quite interesting to follow because it influences the way European producers think about their decarbonization, but it also influences the way producers from abroad think about their decarbonization to access European markets. So I think that's an interesting one. Carbon pricing itself is, I think, not going to be as efficient as it would be if we don't also remove fossil fuel subsidies that continue to exist across the globe. And that's something that we need to come back to again and again and again. And the third, I think, area that can really improve the business case for all of those sectors is the creation of the market. We've mentioned blending mandates in aviation before. Product standards, construction standards can also help drive the demand for greener materials, for greener logistics services. And that's really important because that we can't rely just on voluntary demand to create a market for those products today. So I think those are really the critical areas. And the last one I would throw in is the one Rob was mentioning right now. It's clean energy supply scale up, where we know that the technologies exist, but we're not deploying them fast enough to meet the needs of all of those energy intensive players that in some shape or form, directly or indirectly, will rely on green energy electrons in the future, and that will represent a massive increase in the scale of the power sector we need.
Well, yeah, you've just described there, full steam, the need for business models and the need for huge amounts more power, you know, clean power. And Rob, you were talking about how wind and solar have gone down the cost curve, you know, almost better than anyone expected over the last few years. But with the kind of technological solutions we have for hard to abate sectors, they're earlier stages. So I'm interested, Faustine, is there a risk that these technologies are too costly at this stage and maybe not globally accessible for nations that, for instance, have less resource to put towards climate mitigation? And what does MPP do to try to tackle that potential challenge?
No, they are too costly even to deploy in advanced economies today. And what's quite striking is that despite the phenomenal boost that the IRA constitutes in the US, we're still struggling to see commercial scale projects for low carbon industry reach final investment decisions in the US. And so the complexity of making that happen in emerging economies like India or Brazil that don't have the equivalent of an IRA and also face higher financing challenges is enormous. I think there's still an opportunity we can seize. The fact that solar and wind resources might be much better in some developing economies than they are, for instance, in continental Europe, represents a big opportunity for those countries to become not only a clean energy producers, but to go up the value chain and start producing energy intensive materials like steel or like aluminium, because they will benefit from that clean energy supply that Northern Europe wouldn't have in the future. So I think the shifts in the structure of international supply chains in the future might surprise us, but there's this initial bottleneck of access to the technology and financing in countries that have higher financing risks than advanced economies that needs to be handled through international cooperation. And it's something that is lagging behind today. But it's also the purpose of the new initiative, Industrial Transition Accelerator, that was launched at COP last year, that MPP will be hosting from now onwards, where we will particularly focus on how do we create better conditions for investment in green industry in emerging and developing economies.
Fantastic. So important. So many questions we could ask you. And sadly, we are out of time. So I'm going to end by asking each of you, fairly or not, what is the one intervention you'd like government, business, or finance decision makers to make to catalyze the technological innovation needed for net zero that they're not currently doing or doing enough of? And I'm going to start with you, Ross.
Oh, thanks. Thanks, Simon. I think from an early stage innovate perspective, well, firstly, the reach of this is broad, right? There's so many things that can be done. I think one of the quickest solutions, if I can say that, when it comes to providing an intervention for the early stage innovators that we work with in particular, is far more clarity around how policy development from a sector development perspective links in with innovation development within each one of those sectors. The more clarity and buy-in that innovators have into sector-specific policy developments, targets that are being set, infrastructure projects that are being invested in, the far easier it is for them to flex their business models or at times even pivot their business models to be able to plan for commercialization and scale of those innovations. So there's a lot that government can do in this area, but I think one of the most efficient ways to get innovators to be able to develop their technologies that are market-ready, scalable market-ready products is a far higher degree of engagement from a policy angle in the innovation ecosystem.
Very good. Thank you, Ross. Faustine, same question to you.
I think focusing on how to create the market for all of those products is really important. I think there's a lot of policy developments that have been focused on supporting suppliers, putting in place subsidy schemes of different forms to support investment in the energy intensive sectors. But the energy intensive players were not going to invest if there's no buyers for their products. And so one of the under-leveraged areas of policymaking, I think, is policy around how do you create demand through mandates, through regulations, through bans as well. And we've seen the power of end dates for the purchase and the sales of internal combustion engines in the road transport sectors. So those regulations on demand, I think, are very powerful and actually less costly than subsidy schemes for the public sector to drive the innovation we need and create the market that those innovations require to scale.
Excellent. Rob, you get the last word. Which key intervention or interventions get your vote?
So I'm going to endorse Faustine's sort of support of demand side in policy, which I think is more European, it's more sophisticated. And I'll mention one intervention, which is never going to happen, but it illustrates the economics of this whole problem, which is a global science-derived carbon price. Mm-hmm. So the carbon price that we have today is arrived at through a complicated mechanism, and it's not the necessary price that gets the action. It's just sort of what is a tolerable thing with lobbying and permits and so on. The sort of damage that climate change will cause over the next few decades is a number we can calculate. So the externality that people using carbon intensive processes, so the marginal CO2 that they're emitting, is a number you can get to. And if you did actually apply that cost, that real cost that will cause real suffering and extreme weather events and flooding and heat waves and sort of, you know, forced migration, all this goes away. All the clean energy solutions become cheap. There is no green premium. It is just far cheaper to use a solution that's not damaging the environment we all rely on. It is cheaper to invest in these solutions, including green steel and green aviation fuels, than to carry on with the fossil alternatives and load costs onto our children's and grandchildren's sort of, you know, balance sheets. So it is far cheaper to deal with it now. So that would, it's not going to happen. We have some carbon trading in Europe and the UK and in North America, and it's been helpful. But that lens that this is cheaper, including difficult things like green steel and SAFs, is one for everyone to remember.
Rob, thank you very much. Some seriously nourishing food for thought there to end with. That is all for episode 4 of Net Zero, What's Innovation Got to Do With It? A big thank you to our guests, Faustine de la Salle, Rob Trezona, and Ross Bruton.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And in fact, that brings us to the end of our series all about the important role of innovation in reaching net zero. I am so glad we chose to focus on this topic. As time runs out to tackle the climate crisis, the race is on to unlock the cutting edge and transformational changes that will power the net zero transition. So we need all the innovation we can get.
Throughout the series, we've had the pleasure of speaking to some world-renowned experts on how innovation can be used to achieve the unprecedented challenge of decarbonising the global economy. At the end of all these conversations, I think we should offer an answer to the question, what does innovation have to do with net zero? Well, going first, for me, innovation is clearly critical to achieving net zero, not just in the way that most of us would normally think of when we think of innovation, such as in relation to developing new technologies, but also to scale up critical existing ones like offshore wind at speed, and to develop new models of doing business and new ways of designing policy. But the big lesson from our series, I think, is it won't happen on its own. Through each of our episodes, we've heard how important it is that policymakers, businesses, and financiers collaborate to achieve innovation. When that happens, we've seen extraordinary results, and we urgently need more of that to get to net zero.
I agree. And I'd add, actually, that many of the 7 steps for innovation that Sir Patrick Vallance outlined in our very first episode have been central to our discussions throughout the series. So, for instance, he spoke about the importance of having empowered leadership to drive the change we need. So that means we need politicians on the case. We need business leaders, finance decision makers. He also spoke about being prepared to accept some risk, and that was obviously a major theme of today's discussion, because we know that not every innovation will succeed. And then finally, and you mentioned the important role of government, Sir Patrick spoke about the importance of public-private partnerships, because we need collaboration in terms of supply chains, policy development, global collaboration as well. So that public-private partnership is going to be hugely important too.
Absolutely. We hope the series has sparked new ideas and inspiration on how governments, businesses, financial institutions and individuals can come together to unlock innovation in the transition to net zero. We couldn't end the final episode though without saying a big thank you to everyone who's helped us to make this series. Our producer Matt Hopper at Trisonic, our amazing research and production team at the Carbon Trust, in particular Mariana Guerrero and Chloe St. George, as well as many other colleagues at the Carbon Trust who have helped us with everything from sector expertise to design and marketing.
And thank you, our listeners, for joining us and our guests for this series of fascinating conversations. If you want to learn more about the importance of innovation in accelerating the net zero transition and how the Carbon Trust is working across the world to help unlock that kind of change, then you can head to our website or follow us on social media to stay up to date.
But for now, thanks for listening.
Thank you.